We shall get started as Scott is busy sharing, and I want to invite the rest of you to also share the room on Clubhouse and on social media. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Atlas Society on Clubhouse. My name is Jennifer Anju Grossman. Please call me JAG. I am the CEO of the Atlas Society. We're the leading nonprofit organization introducing young people to the ideas of Ayn Rand in fun, creative ways like graphic novels and animated videos. Today, we have a special Clubhouse. We are joined by the author of The Philosophical Practitioner and a longtime objectivist and friend of the Atlas Society, Larry Abrams. Larry, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
This is awesome. Well, let's kind of set the stage, if we will. Start with telling the audience a bit about your origin story. You got into college as well as investing early, how you discovered Ayn Rand.
Okay, let's see. I guess if you want to, get into the really origin of my investing story, I guess you could go back to my childhood when I was saving pennies of my allowance, and my father told me that if I opened an account, if he opened an account for me at Greenwich Savings Bank, I could put my pennies, once they reached a dollar or so, into the bank, and they would pay me interest just for holding it until I was ready to take it out. And I told him no. And he said, well, Larry, why not? I mean, it's free money. I said, well, Dad, what happens if they don't want to give me my money back? So my father said, Larry, if they don't give you your money back, I'll give you your money. And then I said, yes. And my father, from then on, would tell the story of how he guaranteed the bank.
How old were you about then?
Oh, I don't know. Anything below 10 is...
Okay. 6, 7, something like that.
I guess.
Where did you grow up?
That was Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, okay. And was your dad also in the financial sphere?
No, he was a shop foreman. But as far as let's see now, you want to know about the real investing. I guess that started when I was age 13, and I had a bar mitzvah, and I got various gifts, and one of the gifts was 10 shares of a stock called Bayuk Cigar. And I used to go out and, like all the kids, and play stickball on the streets of Brooklyn. And then I'd come back home, and when it was time for dinner. And one day I came back home, and Dad, as usual, was reading the financial news. And he said, oh, I see you made $10 today. And I said, no, Dad, I was out playing stickball. And he said, well, you have 10 shares of Bayuk Cigar, don't you? And I said, yeah, I guess so. And he shoved the paper at me, and it said, and he put his finger where it said, Bayuk Cigar plus one. So I looked at him blankly. And he said, that means that every share that you own is worth $10 more today. You made $10. And I said, whoa, wait a minute, hold on. Why don't people collect these things? Then they might not ever have to work. And Dad got very mad, and he said, I don't want to hear you say anything like that ever again. Man lives by the sweat of his brow. Anything you do on the side is totally on the side. And I thought, I don't know what his problem is, but I'm going to collect these things. So that's what started me off. Starting college, yeah, I started at the University of Chicago when I was 16, and I graduated at 19, and I then went on to graduate school and then another graduate school. But you know, that's not what you're asking about. So
I'm
please.
Assuming that starting college at 16, I mean, that you must have been the only one, or was that more common?
No, no. The University of Chicago had, I don't know if they still have at this time, but they had at that time a program whereby you would take their, I forget if it's 3 hours or 6 hours, entrance exam, and if you could pass that exam, they would take you in regardless of whether or not you had a high school degree. So I took the exam, and you know, they gave me a scholarship, and there were others in my class who had done the same.
And was college where you learned about Ayn Rand?
Well, no, that was in my second graduate school. I was studying to be a clinical psychologist, and there was a big exam coming the next day. So I went to the university bookstore because I was tired of studying, and I was just looking for something easy to read to divert me. And it had these wire racks that sort of moved in a circular motion. And I looked at the racks, and I saw The Fountainhead. And I thought, all right, well, let's try this one. So totally at random, I bought that book. I stayed up for the next 24 hours reading it without a stop. Well, it was a stop to go to the bathroom, but, you know, you get the impression. You get the idea. And an hour after my having finished it, I went to take the exam, which I suppose I passed. Don't remember much about it. But then when I was done with that particular graduate, that particular attempt to become a clinical psychologist, which I abandoned when I discovered that our textbook said that for all clinical psychology schools, the rate of spontaneous remission is equal to the rate of cure. And so I said, wait a minute, hold it. You mean doing nothing is the same as what I'm going to be offering? And the head of the department told me, let's give you some readings in various schools of psychology and see if there's anything you like. And that didn't work because that made no difference. Because none of the schools said anything other than what that textbook said. So I guess I just... I guess that's it for, there's more. The way I started in investing was that I had, at the end of all the courses that I had taken and the degrees I got, I had no money and I had no job. And my money, the no money amounted to $80, which is what I was down to. And I went around to Wall Street, since I enjoyed investing. I went around, I figured I might as well try that. So I went down to Wall Street and asked for a job as an analyst. And I tried seven different brokerage firms, and they all said, have you taken accounting? And I said, no, I have not taken accounting. After about the third rejection, I read a book on accounting, and the next Wall Street firm that asked me that, I said, no, but I read a book on it. And so that firm and all the others said, no, not good enough. You have to have taken accounting. So I was, since I was down to virtually no money, I figured, okay, even though I have to pay a fee if it works, I have to, you know, I'm pretty desperate here. So I went to a headhunter's office. And in the headhunter's office, there was a bench outside the office. And the door to the office was open. And I was, I guess, number three or so after the person who was already in there. And I heard the person say, well, I'd like to become a securities analyst. And the headhunter said, well, that's unfortunately, there are very few openings for that. And there's one at the Value Line Investment Survey on 44th Street uptown. So I shot to my feet, out the door, into the subway, went to 44th Street, went to the Value Line offices and said, hi there, I'm interested in becoming a securities analyst. And so I expected a whole raft of questions about my experience and about accounting. Nope, none of it. They said, okay, we have three tests for you to take. Start now. And they gave me three different tests. It was math, English, and general reasoning. So I did all that, and I asked them, okay, well, when will I hear? And they said, yeah, you'll hear in approximately 2 weeks. So the next day, the next morning, actually, I got a call from the Value Line saying, we want to hire you. And I thought, wow, a manna from heaven, unbelievable. So they said, wait, when can you start? And I said, how about, oh, in an hour.
That's and great.
So I didn't have really, I didn't want to spend money for the subway or for the bus if I could help it. And I was only about 20 blocks from their office. So I walked there and I went in there and they offered me starting salary, which, you know, whatever they had offered me, I would have said, yes, yes, yes. And I took it, and they tripled my salary in 3 years. And then I got calls from a few brokers who, one in particular, asked me if he could buy the things I was buying after I was finished buying. And I said, absolutely, sure. That'll just push the price up, which is good for me. Yeah, feel free. So somehow or other, word on me got around Wall Street. I have no idea how that happened, but it happened. And I got an offer from two different places. One of them said, you know, what'll make you come here? And I said, well, let's see, how about doubling my salary, private office, private phone. I don't talk to your brokers, but I'll just tell them what I'm recommending. And I have my own hours. And if you don't like how I'm performing, you can. I don't need a contract, just fire me. So they said, fine, it's done. And that was my entire, not only was it my entire Wall Street experience, it was also my entire 9-to-5 experience. Because I left and I thought, okay, I know how to do this now. And I think at that time I had managed to move my negligible net worth up to $250,000. And I said, okay, I know how to do this now. So why do I need to go to an office for that 9-to-5? And that was how the investing began.
And then you moved out on your own?
Oh, I moved out on my own. That's
In terms of, no, not in terms of you're hanging up your own shingle, as opposed to
different.
working for a different firm.
Oh, no, I never had a shingle. I never offered investment advice to any particular clients. What happened was I got somebody came to see me and he said he had heard about me and he was starting an oil company and would I like to join the oil company? And I said, well, why would I want to do that? I'm doing fine doing what I'm doing. And he ex I said, explain to me, why is this your oil company in any way unique? So anyway, after we talked for a while, I told him that I'm not moving into any oil company office. I'm not moving out to Kansas, which is where he was from. But if you want me to do some things on the phone and indicate to prospective clients what you're all about, I'd be happy to do that. So that's what happened there, and that was the, I guess, the only other job I had. Well, except for a job as a stock boy moving textiles when I was 16 between semesters, but that doesn't count. They fired me, by the way, because I kept, since I was working for a textile firm, I kept reading news items relevant to new ideas about textiles and et cetera, et cetera. And I sent them up to, I would send them up to the president. And I got a, he fired me and told me, you don't really want to be a stock boy. Well, he was right about that.
All right. Well, I'm going to want to get into what happened after you read The Fountainhead and how your interest in objectivism eventually led to your meeting Ayn Rand. But would love to get our audience involved. So, Ron, do you have a question for Larry?
No, just a privilege tuning in to Larry's story. Larry's been an investor in my companies and a friend, and I'm an admirer of his, and I love this to hear more of his history.
Thank you, Ron.
Fantastic. And all right, well, I'm going to go back to my questions, but if there are others that would like to come on up and join us and ask a question, don't be shy. So, yeah, Larry, tell us, so you read The Fountainhead, sounds like in a matter of days.
One day, one day.
One day, the entire book. Wow, it
Yep.
must be a speed reader on top of
Nope.
wow, amazing. All right. And then what did you read next? Was it did you read did you just continue to read Ayn Rand's books, or did you leave it aside for a bit and return to it later?
Well, as soon as I found out about that she had written another book, I had to go and get it because the Fountainhead was then and remains today my favorite book in the whole world. So if she had written another book, I had to, find it and get it and read it. But I had no money to buy the book, believe it or not. So this was before my jobs. So I signed up in the local library to get the book, and there was a waiting list for it. But I finally got it. I finally read it, and I had read in the New York Times that both Barbara Brandon and Leonard Peikoff had been giving courses, teaching I don't know what at LIU. And so I called one of them. I don't remember which one, and said, "Oh, I also, the article also mentioned that she had a group that was meeting once a week at her apartment." So I called one of them and told him I'd like to join the group. And he or she talked to me for a while, and then sent me to told me to call Alan Greenspan. So I called Alan Greenspan. And he invited me to his place, his apartment, And I went there with a whole list of questions about Atlas Shrugged. And I must say, he made a remark that puzzles me to this day. He said, "You think you're as smart as I am, don't you?" So I had no idea where that was coming from, and I just sort of shrugged, and we went on. But at any rate, he apparently recommended me to Ian, and I joined the group.
What was it like? About how many people?
Well, there was about, I would say, 10 to 12.
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting. It was, needless to say, you know, I'm sitting in the company of this incredible philosopher, this person who has written the book that I like most of anything I've ever read, and I get to listen to what she says and listen to her answer questions. It was amazing. It was quite amazing.
Now, am I correct that you helped Rand understand the game of chess a bit more? And was this before or after her open letter to Boris Spassky essay?
Well, it was after. In fact, it was why I taught her anything about chess. It was because she had written that, in effect, that chess players, including Spassky, you were wasting their lives on this 64 squares, and it's a whole world out there, etc. And it was a way to avoid reality. And anyway, I said to her that, you know, Ian, if you understood the game, which I can show you, I think you'd really enjoy it. Because, you know, with a mind as powerful as hers, I thought she would really, really enjoy it. And she said, okay. And so she invited me over for, I don't know, five different evenings. And I taught her the moves, which is easy. It's only that takes, you know, maybe 10 minutes. And then what you could do with the moves, and, you know, showed her some of the complications that could arise. And one particular sequence of moves I showed her, because I had her, you know, play me a game as well, and I showed her what I could do in answer to the particular move she had made. And she said, "Oh, that's amazing. That is just wonderful. That and then you could also go here, and you could go here." And and I said, "Ian, that's not a genius move on my part. Any good chess player would see that move." And but she wasn't having any of that. She went on and on about what a beautiful move it was. It never went any past that at all, because you need to practice chess to get any good at it, and to enjoy it, really. And Frank didn't want to play.
Looking back on spending, you know, quite a bit of time with her, what do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions about her as a person today?
Well, you know, I don't follow the misconceptions very much because I have my own conceptions, which are not miss. I know what she was like, and you know, maybe people who were bad-mouthing her and had different experiences with her, I don't know. There was one thing that she did do that always made me uncomfortable, and that was at some of her lectures, you had these sort of naively innocent people who would ask questions. They had no idea what the implications of their questions were, but Ayn Rand was, you know, all the implications flooded in on her as soon as the person would ask it, and she would sometimes get angry and berate the questioner for having asked the question, and also, you know, saying that what it meant about their psychology to have been asking that question. And that was in front of a whole audience, and I didn't like that. So that's the only conception, you know, negative conception that I know of. So I don't know about any of the misconceptions.
I also want to invite David and Scott, who are with us. If at any time you have a question or wanted to jump in, please feel free to do that.
Can you tell us maybe any other just insights about her that, you know, other people may not have known about that you learned about?
Well, I don't think I had any. Well, I guess maybe I wouldn't call this an insight. I was about to say I don't think I had any particular insights that other people don't know about, because everybody knows that she was a blazing genius, and that her intelligence shone out of her eyes, and she would get, you know, turned on. Even if she was dead tired, she would get turned on by any philosophy conversation, and she would do this way into the wee hours. But the only thing she did that I thought was I didn't quite understand, but you know, it's perfectly understandable, and really in anybody, which was. She loved the Perry Mason show, and she would put it on while we were having the group session, the group conversation, I should say, because she just always loved to look at it. And one day she put it on, and the TV wasn't working well, and so she told Frank, Frank, can you fix the TV? The show is starting and it's not working. So Frank went to the TV and started working on it, and wasn't getting anywhere. And she said, Frank, the show is starting. Can you hurry up? And Frank immediately took umbrage of that and said, okay, you fix it. And he left and stormed out of the room. And I don't remember whether she went after him or not, but she was just a little bit impatient. And that interaction was a big surprise to me.
It's a great story. Thanks.
So as a longtime objectivist, maybe tell a little bit about how you got involved with the Atlas Society, your history with the Atlas Society, any thoughts on the whole debate about open versus closed objectivism?
Well, as far as open versus closed, which is more interesting, I'll get back to the first one, the first question, but that's more interesting. Philosophy is pretty much the architectonic of all the sciences. It's the most comprehensive and complex of the humanities. And it's also the most crucial to your life, of course, whether your philosophy is implicit or explicit. The full implications of a given philosophy are, if not infinite, then close enough. And closing off examination of those implications is not a wise strategy. Now, you could talk about potential additions, potential deletions. They would presumably, if your philosophy is well attuned to reality, there will not be very many deletions, but there can be lots of additions, because, you know, nobody nobody can think of everything all the time. Sorry, not all the time. Can think of everything in one brief lifetime. Sorry, what was the first question?
Oh, it was just about how you got introduced to the Atlas Society, David Kelly, your history within the Objectivist movement itself, even post-Rand.
Well, let's see. I don't know. David, do you remember how we met? I just don't remember.
I don't remember exactly, Larry, but I know it was in the 70s sometime when I began getting involved. I went to New York and was living there. I got to know Harry Binswanger, among others. And as I recall, you and Harry were friends at the time. That's,
yeah,
I'm guessing that's how I met you.
We were very good friends, yeah. That's another story which... which is as long as the totality of the stories I've told so far, but some other time.
Yeah, you told me what's some of the details, but I'll let that one go, Larry, because I know we have other questions and you have not much time. So, Jennifer, back to you.
Maybe, Larry, a bit about how you got involved in chess competition. And, you know, was it your father who taught you chess or how that to be such a big part of your life?
Yeah, it's a game that I loved, and I still love. And I became New York City Mensa chess champion and Connecticut State chess champion, none of which I could do today. But the way I got involved was my father would be playing chess with my uncle on our porch pretty reasonably regularly. And I was watching and I was wondering what was so intriguing about this, you know, little board with these little pieces. So I asked him to teach me the game. And he said, no, I'm not going to teach you the game. You're too young. I don't remember how young I was, but this annoyed me. So I had a friend in elementary school who knew how to play the game. And I asked him to teach me. So he taught me and he showed me the moves and he showed me, you know, what the point of the game was. And I lost four out of the first four games. But from then on, I was hooked, and I played in elementary school. I played with the math teacher, and I won a game. We only played one game. I won that game, and then when I went to to high school, Brooklyn Tech, I joined the chess club, and they had tryouts for the chess team, and I joined the chess team, and we went around playing chess with various other teams in various other schools. That's about how I got into chess.
Have you watched The Queen's Gambit?
Oh yeah, that was great fun. Not very realistic, but great fun.
In what ways was it the most unrealistic?
Well, let's see, where would I start? I'd say learning from the janitor to start with, learning the moves from the janitor and playing with the janitor. I really don't know of, I won't say any janitors who have any kind of competence at chess and would be able to teach it. The fact that she was on drugs, on highs, that's not at all typical of chess, but uh, the way she went right through so many grandmasters at the end was not realistic. It doesn't happen that way. There are ups and downs, and you know, you win a few, you lose a few. Even the current world champion, who is presumably, and I agree, the best player who ever lived, loses lots of games. And then at the very end, they have her walking through the through a park where chess players playing in the park. There are chess players, and one of them challenges her to a game, and you know, she says, "Fine, you know," and that that it's possible, but she's going to be so far. She's world champion. It's going to be totally uninteresting to her to play anybody at the park level. So that, you know, not quite realistic, but still great fun, well worth watching.
All right, let's talk a little bit about your book, The Philosophical Practitioner. It's a love story, a mystery, an exploration about what life is all about. What inspired you to write it?
Well, first I had to be inspired to write fiction in the first place, and I always wanted to write fiction. I guess what inspired me to do that is just enjoying it so much. But I put off writing fiction much too long, and one day I asked myself the classic question, if not now, when? So I wrote the book, and when you write fiction, you write about what you like to read. And it's great if you can couple that with ideas you think are important. And while you're doing that, you create a sense of excitement and discovery in your readers. It was gratifying to see that some of the Amazon reviews went even beyond what I just said. And I had never seen some problems that everyone has treated the way I wanted to treat them, entertainingly in the particular manner that I wanted to. That's about all, I guess.
Can I jump in with a question for Larry?
Well, it's okay with me.
Okay, thank you. You're the guest of honor here. Larry, I remember talking a bit when you sent me pretty much the finished book. But one thing that struck me as I read it is that there have been quite a few novels, fiction, or written by objectivists. And I'm sorry to say this, but an unfortunate number of them sound too much like Ayn Rand. And
the rest sound like robots.
Yeah. Yours doesn't. I mean, it was just an original idea. It took me, I think that, you know, okay, what's Larry up to here? And so I wondered how he came up with the story of the practitioner and the mysterious woman who engages his services.
You know, that's a very good question, and I have no answer. I don't know how I came up with it. I've always been, a fan of good dialogue. Now, you know, that has to tie into it all. And I always enjoyed, in the real world, good dialogue with anybody that I was speaking to. Hard to find, but nevertheless gratifying when you find it. And it's as far as the humor in there, which you didn't ask about, but that's okay. as far as the humor in there is concerned, that's just me. That's just the way I think. And so I just wrote it down on the page as well. Let's see.
All right. We've got another question, I think, from Lawrence. And again, I want to invite anybody who's here with us, feel free to raise your hand and we'll bring you on up. Lawrence, you have a question for Larry.
I do. Thank you. Hi, Larry. So
Hi.
You mentioned chess and how you decided to sort of instruct Ayn Rand after she had written that letter. And I was curious to hear your thoughts. How do you think chess shaped how you think, maybe? Because, you know, often chess is a very thinking game and it can often influence in other ways. You know, certain hobbies can change our outlook on other things we do in our life. And I'm curious if chess had that effect on you.
Well, very little. Chess itself, very little. But I'll make a collateral comment after I explain that. Chess, it really is just, you know, confining yourself to 64 squares and seeing all the implications that can occur on those 64 squares when you define your pieces in a particular way. And it requires, you know, great ingenuity. But, and this is a big but, it's only spatial ingenuity. There are people, I've met many people, including, unfortunately, some grandmasters, which is as high as you can go, who have, well, nothing to recommend them at all other than their chess playing ability. They don't have any other abilities. Of course, this doesn't apply to everybody, but it applies to many. It's very easy to become a chess bum if you're hooked by the beauty and of the game. And a lot of really good chess players don't do anything else. They get along on one of them that I know became a bicycle messenger in order to just earn enough money to eat while he was doing his chess. And he was an extremely good player. He was called an international master, which he still is. So I think chess itself didn't teach me very much, except you can't take your moves back. Once you make a move, it's done. You have to live by it. And, you know, that, but that's, I don't know that that, that anybody requires chess to understand something like that. I don't think that's, I don't think that's what it taught. But so it taught me, not the game didn't teach me much, but the meeting a lot of the people and how they perform under pressure, you know, how they, what they do. Hang on a second. What they do and how they handle themselves. Am I still on?
Yeah, Larry. Okay. I thought that was interesting. I'm familiar with surf bums living out here in Malibu. Met a few ski bums over the course of my life, but never thought of a chess bum.
Oh yeah, there are many. For example, there was I was playing in a. They have speed tournaments. Speed tournaments means you do all the moves of the game in 5 minutes. There were weekly tournaments on Friday nights at the Manhattan Chess Club. And I was playing in one of these tournaments, and there was this pretty good chess player who I was playing, and I won the game. And first, set the scene. It's very quiet in a chess club. You're not supposed to make any noise. Everybody's concentrating. So I won the game, and the guy sweeps all the pieces off the board onto the floor, and says, "If you'll excuse me, one word. You play this shit and you win." Now this is, you know, this is not atypical. Right, the behavior itself is atypical, but the attitude is not.
Interesting. I think maybe also what Lawrence was getting at was just if you have a hobby and it might train you to be creative, it might train you to be always thinking about a few moves ahead or a few steps ahead, and maybe that could apply to investing in some ways, that you're looking at the economy, you're looking at opportunities. It's kind of a chessboard and thinking about things globally and what the allotment and deployment of the pieces are now, where things are going, that kind of thing.
Well, Jennifer, to extend that, if and when Larry is inclined, how did objectivism, what are some of the most important ways that it affected you as an investor?
Great question.
Oh, that's an interesting question. Let me think whether it did, and if so, how it did. No, I don't think I don't think it did. I think they were two, for me at least, I think they were two entirely different realms.
You've talked about keeping your emotions in check. I think that's kind of related.
Yeah, but I don't know that it's chess that taught me that. Also, it's harder in chess to keep your emotions in check than it is in investing. At least, certainly, that was the case for me.
Well, you once told me a story that I remember vividly, that when you were investing, I think the subject was oil drilling, and people had various attitudes about risk, and you looked at it more individually and objectively than most people do, and you thought that was a key to your success. Do I have the story right?
Yeah. At the time, I don't know how this has changed now, since it's been a very long time since then, but at the time, the success in drilling wildcat oil wells, wildcat being defined as something far from current production, and who knows if it'll hit or not. You have various indications that it might, but it's still way up in the air. The success rate for that was 1 in 9. So, obviously, to me at least, if you want to invest in oil, which has had at the time and has even more so now, very big upside when you hit, you have to spread your bets. You don't want to put your oil investing money into one drilling location or oil well, because these chances are 9 out of 10 you're going to lose it. So I would do that. I used to do that. And I was once, this is kind of really apposite to your question. I was once having lunch with a partner in a Wall Street firm. The first name was Mike, which is totally irrelevant, but there you go. And he was asking me, what was I doing? And I was asking him what he's doing. And I was telling him about the oil well investing I was doing, and I asked him, I told him what the odds were. 9 out of 10 are going to bomb, 1 out of 10 will succeed. And he, I asked him if he wanted to join me in my next oil venture, and he said, I can't do that. And I said, well, wait, Mike. It's true that only 1 in 10 is going to hit, but if it hits, your average return is 30 to 1. So what do you say now? Do you want to invest in that? He said, no, I can't do it. Now, this is a partner in a Wall Street firm who's used to looking at odds and investing on the basis of odds, because nobody knows the future. Nobody knows what a particular investment will return. And he couldn't do it. And it's obviously totally irrational. If somebody said, you're going to make 3 to 1 at the end of this deal, or in all probability, he said, wow, that's count me in. But no, he couldn't do it. And he's not atypical. So I don't know how far that goes to answering your question.
Great. Can I talk just quickly about your work in life extension and biotech? I think, you know, the kind of end game of morality with life of the, as the standard of value should be focused on that. And I'm kind of curious what you see as the, you know, most likely innovation that we should be following. If you were a young entrepreneur getting into it, what field would you be exploring?
Well, biotechnology. Biotechnology is, you know, proceeding at warp speed, as a few other areas are, and it's extremely exciting. These new drugs that you read about all the time, the pace of discovery is truly unbelievable. I remember there was several years ago, I saw a cartoon which stuck with me, which is this guy is sitting in a doctor's office across the desk from a doctor, and the doctor is saying, as yet there is no cure, but if you'd like to wait for tomorrow's mail. So that was then. Now it would be if you care to wait till this afternoon's tweets or whatever. It's biotechnology I always thought that was where it's at as far as innovation in potential life extension was, and I still think that.
And you were an early advocate for what became the Right to Try legislation, Larry. Are there other reforms that you'd recommend now to make more innovation in the field of biotechnology and more rational risk-taking possible?
Well, yeah. The first thing would be get rid of the FDA. And if you don't want to get rid of it because it sounds too radical, make it a purely advisory body, so that you can put a label on your drug and say the FDA has not approved this. And what would happen, you know, people would immediately, if I were to advocate this, people would immediately say, well, you know, people are going to die. You need the government to tell you what's working, what's done. You need clinical trials. I think what would happen if you had no FDA is that immediately, since there would be such a demand for it, private companies would come up doing clinical trials and making recommendations, and then you could make your own decisions based on that, or you could hire more than one. But the main thing is, there would be no coercive body anymore standing between a willing buyer and a willing seller. You know, what are people who have terminal diseases supposed to do if a drug is in trials and you know, they can't buy it and the company can't sell it? Sure, there's such a thing as compassionate use, but that's not many pass that test because the government runs it. There wouldn't be such a test. You'd read all the data that's available so far, and you'd say, okay, I'm going to die in 3 months. I'm going to try it. What do I have to lose? So anyway, that would be the biggest reform that I can think of. The other reform would be, you know, stop suing all the drug companies and biotech companies, treating them as milk cows. Because every time you do that, and every billion that you take away from them, you know, diminishes their ability to invest that particular chunk of money in potential new drugs.
Just to close the things up, Larry, as an investor, I would love to get your thoughts on the current economy, the Biden administration's performance, inflation. We've had economists on to critique that, and people like Art Laffer and Steve Moore and Steve Forbes. But from your perspective, are we headed for a recession? And are you optimistic or pessimistic about where we're going over the next couple of years?
Well, all right. The question, are we headed for a recession? That's totally impossible to answer because the economy is made up of so many moving parts and billions of interactions every day. So predicting the net effects with any precision is not possible. It's incalculable.
Talk really more about whether you are in a recession, right? So if you're in a sector that's booming, or you're in a sector that's dying, then you're in a particular, it's more personal rather than thinking about the economy as a whole.
That's right. That's absolutely right. That said, I can certainly talk about odds. The odds of a not only a recession but a prolonged one and a bad one, I think the odds are well above 50-50. Of course, that brings up an interesting question, which is really not apposite here, but it's which is that there are billions of interactions and it's impossible to calculate it. So my statement of my odds are based on being impossible to calculate and being impossible to know. So my estimate as to whether that will happen may and will differ completely from people who are looking at another subset of data. But the interesting question that it brings up is that let's say the odds are 60%. Well, given what I just said about the imprecision of any particular forecast, what are the odds that my statement of the odds is correct? And you could go on like that for a long time, but that's that just bends your mind.
Well, we've had enough. We've definitely expanded our mind over the past hour. This really, Larry, was a tour de force from philosophy to fiction, from chess to investing, to these precious and priceless memories of Ayn Rand and your time with her. It's just been a real treat, and we're so grateful. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you for feeling that way.
And thank you also for all that you do for the Atlas Society in terms of allowing us to continue on our work of engaging young people with these ideas that have really so nourished and enriched our lives. So we appreciate it.
Very happy to do it.
Okay. Let me add my own thanks, Larry. This is great to hear you.
Yeah. Thank you, David. Thank you very much.
All right, I'm going to toss it to Scott to tell us about what's coming up next.
Thank you. Tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern, a student event, Richard Salzman hosting Morals and Markets on Collegiate Cronyism. Next Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern, Corey DeAngelis will be the guest on the Atlas Society Asks. And then 1 week from today in Malibu is our gala honoring Michael Saylor. We're going to have the scholars during the day doing panels. It's going to be a lot of fun. If you're in Southern California or able to attend, I encourage you to go to atlassociety.org/gala. We hope to see you there. Larry, it was great. Thank you so much. Jag,